Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in the space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Good afternoon to everyone along Florida's Space Coast and to those of you online everywhere at WMMBAM.com. This is Space Talk for August 8th, 2009, and I am your host, Jim Behnke. If you're joining us for the first time, welcome. This is the show where we talk about everything and anything having to do with the space program. And today we're going to focus on the life stories of some remarkable people who have spent their lives making a difference in our space program from right here in Florida. You can be a part of today's show by calling in anytime to 768-1240 or star 1240 if you're an AT&T wireless customer here on Florida's Space Coast. If you're beyond the local area somewhere, you can still reach us by dialing 321-768-1240 or send us some email right now to spacetalking@AOL.com. And we monitor that AOL website throughout the show, so feel free to send in your questions and comments there. Well, let's pick up some space news that's happened this past week. Want to mention a couple of things before we get into the meat of the program. First of all, Discovery rolled out to launch pad 39A this past Tuesday in preparation for a launch that hopefully will be no earlier than August 25th on mission STS-128, another flight to the International Space Station. It took Discovery a little bit longer than normal to get out to the launch pad, about 12 hours to cover the 3.5 miles. All of that rain that we've been having here on the Space Coast for the last couple of weeks left the crawler transporter and the path that it takes the crawler way a little bit muddy, a little bit wet in places, and that actually slowed down that giant crawler where each one of its cleats weighs 1 ton, giving the crew time to, I guess, wash off the mud from the cleat before they could keep going. So that slowed them down. There was a little problem going up the ramp as well that delayed them a little bit, but by the time it was all said and done, 12 hours after the fact, Discovery is perched at pad 39A. And again, they're hoping to get off the ground by August 25th. There are a couple of issues that the launch team is working out there. There's some solid rocket booster hydraulic system issue that they have to resolve, actually do some repairs out at the pad. And there's still some concern about the external tank foam that fell off during Endeavour's mission during its launch here a couple of weeks ago that they're still examining and taking a close look at to make sure that that won't be an impact to Discovery's flight. If it is an impact, then that could be a long delay, and so they're looking at it carefully. Managers will meet for the flight readiness reviews later this week on, I guess it's the middle of this week, and then a final executive decision probably expected early next week on the launch. In the meantime, the crew for that mission did come in on Wednesday to the Cape and went through their standard terminal countdown demonstration test procedures, simulations, rehearsals, and all of that of launch day, and that went well on Friday. So the crew was here and out by now. So that's kind of the update on Discovery. We'll keep an eye on that launch date for you and let you know what's going on. In the meantime, I think the big news of the week from NASA was that the Kepler science mission sent down some interesting pictures from orbit. Kepler is a small science telescope that was launched from the Cape on March 6th. Right here, and its purpose is to look for planets around other stars in the galaxy, and Earth-like planets, in fact, that may have water. Don't know whether that means there's life there or not, but certainly planets that are very much like Earth in the same region of orbit around other suns as the Earth revolves around our sun. And what they did was they went and looked at a star as part of the whole kind of test and checkoff procedure that they knew already had a planet circling it, and they went and used Kepler to see if they could see the same signature. And in fact, it worked beautifully. There aren't enough words to describe the scientists bending over backwards trying to figure out new words to describe how good this telescope worked, and it's still early in its checkout phase. And so the hope is that this planet, or this planet hunter, we'll be able to go find some very interesting things. Now, we're talking about, in this case, a star that's about 1,000 light years away from the Earth. A light year is a measurement of distance, not of time, and it's about 6 trillion miles for a single light year. So this thing is like way out there, and yet they're able to detect this tiny little planet actually going across the surface of the sun as it appears from Earth, transiting across the sun, and able to see that. And it's just absolutely amazing that what they can do and pinpoint all that. So that's what's going on out in space this past week of interest. Meanwhile, closer to home, well, this weekend is the This weekend is the Pro Football Hall of Fame weekend, the induction ceremony tonight, the big game tomorrow. And why is that important? Because you know what? Right here in the Space Coast, we kind of have our own induction ceremony going on this week. The National Space Club Florida Committee has selected its 3 winners this year for the Lifetime Achievement Awards. And those awards will be given out at a luncheon this Tuesday in Cocoa Beach. And here on the line to tell us a little bit more about the club and the awards is this year's chairman of the National Space Club Florida Committee, the respected and beloved Roy Tharp. Roy, are you on the line there?
I sure am, Jim, and congratulations to you and your show. And I was sorry I couldn't be on for your 40th anniversary with Apollo with Dick Bagley and Bob Seek.
Well, that was a good show, and we missed you. But tell us today about the club and tell us about the awards.
Let's see. Our Space Club, the National Space Club Florida Committee, is 260 members strong. And we take and recognize, this is our 17th year that we're recognizing the Lifetime Achievers. And we have 3 great ones, and you'll be talking to those folks later on. I am really honored that I have worked with each and every one of those folks. And the selection criteria for those folks are they're longtime contributors to our space program, either at the Kennedy Space Center or at Cape Canaveral Air Force Station, whether they're civil servants or contractor, and that they have retired, that they have had a splendid career in our business and gone on to those golden years. So we're very excited about that.
Yeah, now talk about the Space Club a little bit more. One of the things we do, and I'm part of the board of directors, honored to be a member and part of the group there for many years now. Talk about some of the other things. We give awards, but I think the thing that may most surprise a lot of folks in Brevard County is what we do with the 6th graders out at the Kennedy Space Center.
Well, one of our activities for the year is Space Week. We take every 6th grader that's in the Brevard County schools, and we bring them to the Visitors Information Center for a day. We take and have executives that meet with them. Mm-hmm. We have astronauts that meet with them. We have promotions. We have science projects. And this past year, we had 5,141 students, 304 teachers, and 250 chaperones at a cost of over $108,000. And we, the Space Club membership, through our industry and government partners, take and are the underwriters for that program.
And we're always looking for more help along that way, too. It's a great program. We want to keep going.
Always do, and I will say one of our Lifetime Achievers passed away last week, and he has set up a Memorial Space Week Fund, Horace Lambert, and you could go to our website,
right.
nfcfl.org, and for those that want to honor Horace with part of their memorial contribution, they can do that on our website.
With about 30 seconds to go, is this club open to anyone and everyone?
Yes, it is.
And how do you join?
They can take and join online, or they can come to our luncheon at 11:30 at the Doubletree on Tuesday, and we'd be excited to welcome them to a great luncheon and a wonderful reminiscent talking to Jerry Opliger, Jerry Johnson, and Gunther Wimp.
Great. Roy, thanks a lot for being on with us. We're gonna have Jim Johnson on next year shortly here on Space Talk on WMMB. As today we talk to at least 2 of the 3 Lifetime Achievement Award winners. The 3rd one might join us. But we'll be back more with Space Talk with me, Jim Banky, in just a few minutes.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240 and star 1240 for AT&T wireless customers. Bugs.
During these troubled economic times, you may have questions about your financial future. The experts at FPT Services in Rockledge have the answers. They'll listen to you, develop a custom plan, and work as your partner with a full array of financial and estate planning services. Don't wait for the economy to recover. Call FPT Services in Rockledge at 631-0383. That's 631-0383. Find them online at fptservices.com.
And now back to Space Talk on WMMB.
Welcome back, everybody. I am Jim Banky, and this is Space Talk on AM 1240 and 1350 WMMB. Join us right now by calling in at 321-768-1240 or star 1240 for the local AT&T wireless customers. And again, you can send us email to spacetalking@aol.com. Well, today we're talking about the Lifetime Achievement Award winners from the National Space Club Florida Committee. The Space Club going to honor three men this Tuesday at a luncheon in Cocoa Beach. And we're pleased to have at least two of the three with us on the program today. A chance that the third one will call in. But first up, I want to welcome Jim Johnson, who started with his career with Boeing in 1955, later joined NASA, working very much on the unmanned rocket side, mostly on the payloads, included, I think, most interesting, Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11. We'll talk about that in a minute. He moved over to payload operations on the space shuttle and then eventually worked space station. He later, on the space station side, got to work with the international partners, spending a lot of time with Canadians. And when he retired in 1995, he was the deputy manager of the Russian Integration Office, and he actually got to spend a little bit of time in Moscow. Since then, retiring from working, I think he's probably even gotten busier working a variety of space community organizations, volunteering at the Kennedy Space Center in a variety of capacities. He's certainly served at a lot of different roles in the Canaveral Council of Technical Societies and with the NASA Alumni League. And with that brief introduction, let's welcome Jim Johnson. And Jim, congratulations on your award from the Space Club.
Thank you, Jim. Appreciate that.
Good. Well, let's see. When you think back on all of that, Jim, what stands out as some of the highlights of your career to you?
To me, Pioneer 10 did for sure, obviously. First spacecraft to Jupiter to take pictures of Jupiter. First one to carry into space RTGs because solar cells are not that effective at that distance. That's a milestone.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the fact that working with the JPL SpaceNet, it took 90 minutes for a round-trip communication to that spacecraft. That's how far away it is. Also, I spent my 3.5 years in Canada as the NASA rep to the Canadian Space Agency on the new shuttle, on the new space station arm.
Uh-huh.
That was an exciting time.
Now, talk for a little bit more about Pioneer 10. Now, talk about when it launched and on top of, was it an Atlas Agena that it went?
No, it went on Atlas Centaur.
Atlas Centaur.
With a Delta third stage added to the top of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it required an additional third stage. Wasn't enough energy even for an Atlas Centaur to get it to the 560-pound spacecraft to Jupiter.
And so as a payload guy at that point, you're working what's in the nose cone at the top of the rocket, and you must have had everything crossed that you could possibly cross at launch time.
Had to have everything crossed. The most important thing was installing the RTGs, because they did it very late in the countdown. Had to be after the fairing was on, so it extended through the fairing hatches, little hatches, in order to install the RTGs, radioisotope thermoelectric generators.
Right, essentially nuclear material that gives off heat, and the heat is converted into electricity.
That's correct.
And so those go on, and I assume that was kind of heavy and very interesting to put through the wall of the nose cone at the last minute.
It was. It was very interesting. You had to have special handling mechanisms in order to install them, and then they had to be retracted back into it on a set of rails.
So now the thing launches, and maybe even as a big picture question, I think a lot of people wonder about the folks that work at the Kennedy Space Center that, you know, once that rocket lifts off, it's kind of like we're done with it, and it's somebody else's problem, if you will. It's someone else's baby to worry about. When Pioneer 10 takes off and takes that long distance to Jupiter, how often did you keep track of things? Were you watching weekly status reports and holding your breath when it finally went into went on the close flyby?
Oh, yes, I was. In fact, I was at Ames Research Center when the flyby took place.
Really? And in an official capacity?
In an official capacity. I was invited by Ames to come out to it since I had been the payload representative here at Kennedy.
Were you able to contribute anything to the operation itself, or was it as an observer?
I was just as a guest host.
Okay, very cool. Now, and talking a little bit about the Canadians now, moving rapidly forward here. The Canadians have been famous in our shuttle program and now with station for handling the robotics and the robot arm. And the one thing I've never really understood is why Canadians and robots? Was there anything unique about their history, their culture, the program that made them be the ones, the experts on that?
I believe what got them into it, naturally, was the first shuttle arm. But then they begin to see applications for it. Their agency, the Canadian Space Agency, was a spinoff of their National Science Foundation. And they begin to really look at robots for use in mining and other areas, also shipbuilding, long before we probably thought of it too much, even in the automobile industry.
Well, and working with them, and we'll talk about the Russians in just a minute, but given that I know what we're going to talk about with the Russians, in terms of the Canadians, were there cultural things? I mean, they are neighbors to the north, and other than the accent, I think we're very much alike.
In quite a few ways we are. But the one thing they informed me was that I was an American and they were Canadians. And I said, well, aren't we all Americans? And they said, no, you're an American.
Hmm.
They kind of want to draw a little distinction. They have very much pride in the country, in Canada.
And I've seen that with their astronauts. And every time that a new arm or new robot piece is flown to the station, they are very proud of that. And I still think that's just fascinating. Why the robotics? I mean, there's so much more you could do. Have you ever got the sense that they want to do more than that, or is it a budget thing? Or
well, you know, they did launch. They had a spacecraft in orbit back in the late '60s. They had put up the Alouette out of Vandenberg Air Force Base on a Thor Agena.
Mm-hmm.
That was their first satellite, and they were the third country to put a satellite in orbit.
Wasn't that?
The Alouette.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of if that had some. What I want to say is, without checking my facts, is that it was the first quote unquote commercial launch, or the first launch by NASA for somebody else.
I don't know whether that was true or not, Jim. It could have been Telstar, could have been the first one.
Huh.
That came a little earlier than Alouette.
Yeah. Well, Alouette, so it goes up and it does its thing, and they've been interested in the space program ever since.
Ever since.
Well, talk about the Russians now. You retired as the deputy integration manager out there. That was a job here, located here?
No, actually, I was at JSC at the time.
Okay.
When they closed down the space station office in Reston, I was transferred to JSC in the space station office, and I was working with the Russians at that time. We just brought them in as partners.
And you did spend a week in Moscow?
I went over for the first joint program review in 94. Between us and the Russians.
And you got back home and you looked at each other and you said what?
I said, this is unbelievable that I've been there. I remember walking through Red Square with one of the ex-Navy guys who was working on the program, and he made the comment, I never thought I'd see this place except through a bomb site.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
It was amazing to be able to be there and start to work with the Russians.
By the time you had gotten that first meeting, how far along were you into the negotiations? Because what I understand about Russians is they're tough negotiators, and when you sign the contract, you better meet the contract.
Yes, you had. You'd better meet it.
And how soon? Were you already aware of kind of that cultural thing by then, or were you just in the learning phase?
No, we were getting pretty much aware of it by that time. We started working with them in the late 92. So by the time 94 come, you had a good feel of what you had to deal with.
Hmm. Now talk about, you know, when you retired, you went on and you've stayed busy. So tell us about some of the things you've done to, I guess, keep promoting the space program in your own way.
Well, I'm also work with the public affairs out here as a host or tour guide for launches and other activities.
Uh-huh.
I also do a lot of new employees tours out here because we can tell them things that used to be. I don't know whether that young people are that interested in it, but they got to listen to us anyway.
That's right. What's the highlight? What are people most surprised about when you give a tour out here?
They're surprised on the Cape side because of all of the facilities that was there have been taken down.
Yeah.
You drive down the ICMM Road, and you realize that all the gantries are gone, but the blockhouses are still there. And they're amazed that most of them didn't realize how much hardware was already there.
Yeah.
Of course, back in those days, we had as many as anywhere from 25, 30 launches a year. And we're lucky probably we have 8 or 10 a year now.
Right. I've always been fascinated by, first of all, how much space there is out there, just how much land. People don't realize that that is a big facility. And how many different organizations were a part of everything out there.
Huge facility. Nobody realizes it. And it's unfortunate that it's all kind of grown over now with weeds and et cetera, because you can't see some of the old sites anymore.
That's right. Jim, we're starting to a little bit run out of time here, but let's talk really quickly about Canaveral Council of Technical Societies and about the NASA Alumni League. What are both of those organizations up to these days?
Well, Canaveral Council of Technical Society, you know, used to run Space Congress.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to revitalize a junior Space Congress if they can. They're trying to put together something to support students.
Right.
High school students primarily.
Okay.
Not sure that's going to materialize, but we have to deal with the school board. We got to go out and get the school board behind us.
Sure. And what about the NASA Alumni League? Who's that open to?
It's open to all the retired NASA people, and also any NASA person that ever worked for NASA, it's open to them to come, too. But we bring invited guests, too.
Okay, and programs and speeches and whatnot every once in a while?
We had the center director this past year, the deputy center director. We also had one of the astronauts come talk to us. We also had the Ginger Davis from the school board talked to us about Space Week.
Oh, that's great. Well, Jim, thanks a lot for your time today. Congratulations again for the award. We're going to be back in just a couple of minutes here at the bottom of the hour with more Lifetime Achievement Award winners from the Space Club. In the meantime, this is Jim Banky with Space Talk on WMMB.
If it's happening in space, Jim Banky is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
Welcome, everyone, back to the second half of this week's Space Talk. I am your host, Jim Banky. And again, we invite you to participate by calling in with your questions or comments to 321-768-1240 or *1240 on your local AT&T wireless cell phone. And today and throughout the week, be sure to check up on what's going on with the program by visiting the Space Talk website at WMMBAM.com and use the keywords Space Talk to find that page. Well, we're talking about Lifetime Achievement Award winners again today. Two of the three winners joining us on the program, the award to be given by the National Space Club Florida Committee this Tuesday during a luncheon in Cocoa Beach. And in terms of our next guest, let's give you some hints here. If you've seen the Ron Howard film, Apollo 13, and you heard Tom Hanks say in the character of Jim Lovell at one point, "I wonder where Gunther went," well, then you know who he is, and I know where he is, and I'm happy to say he's going to join us here in seconds by phone from Merritt Island. Gunther is originally from Germany and has never lost his accent. And I think that's great. And he became an American citizen in 1955, is probably most famous for being the person who was in the White Room atop the launch pad to see off every manned spaceflight crew during projects Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo. In fact, all of the Apollo hardware through the Skylab missions and the Apollo-Soyuz test project flight. Following that, he worked on crew safety issues in the shuttle program. And retired in 1989, he then continued to participate in the space program as a consultant and as an author. In 2001, his book, The Unbroken Chain, was published. And to this day, he is a constantly sought-after speaker, a consultant on anything having to do with space history. And as you will hear, he's never short on things to say about NASA and our future in space. Gunther, my good friend, welcome to the program. And congratulations on your award, sir.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be on the program with you and see if we can spread the word around as to what we need to do in the near future.
Well, we're going to do that, sir, in just a second. Let's talk about your career first, and then we'll give you some time to talk about that. When you look back on your career, Gunter, what stands out as the things that you did that perhaps you're most proud of?
Now, as a matter of fact, you've got to realize we started the program in the late 50s, early 60s, from the Air Force Base. And at that time, we had 15 to 20 missile launches a week. But 3 out of 5 were failures.
Yeah.
And it was interesting when we started down here, this so-called a manned space program, the old missile people looked at us and says, you are nothing actually but nose cones. And finally we had to straighten them out and tell them that their rockets only lasted and had to void 2 to 5 minutes, and then they never saw them again. Well, we had to bring ours back.
Safely.
And do it safely. You know, so we had a rather interesting start. Now, to begin with, the big change and the big impact was when we tried to launch Shepard. All of a sudden, the people working on missiles and working at the Cape and so on were realizing that previously when we had a nose cone failure, you just shrugged it off as saying, oh, there goes another nose cone, you know, we'll mm-hmm. take another one.
Right.
But now all of a sudden you realize, oh, wait a minute, there is a human being in that nose cone.
And suddenly they got interested.
And that was rather a big shake-up. As a matter of fact, when we started to launch Shepard for the first time, you know, we had tried 3 times and scrubbed, and so finally we launched him. And I happened to be at the fallback area, and it was interesting. That was the first time that I see that many grown men cry.
Mm.
Because it was a big, big impact. And so that was a start when people had to change their mind about launching people.
Wow.
Now, it was not an easy lesson to take, because after we got off the Mercury Redstone program, we were shifting to the Atlas program.
Right.
And so then we were looking to launch Glenn, but between that and the previous thing, we had 3 Atlas failures.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a rather discouraging thing. And as a matter of fact, at one time, John and I went to the local church on the beach where we had a youth camp with young people, and we talked about the first launch and putting a man into space, and not rather very pleasantly, but I directed the scenery to explain that we could lose the man if he bounces off the Earth's atmosphere.
Sure.
And stays in space. So I asked the question, if we kill the first astronaut, should we then cancel the whole program? And after a silence of maybe a minute, and one young man spoke up, he says, no, you don't really have to cancel the program. Just take another guy, you've got 7. So then I mentioned to him, I said, you know, I wonder what one of the guys would think, because my friend here, John, happens to be one of the 7.
Oh, yeah.
And along the same lines, Anne Glenn, John's wife, asked me if I could guarantee her a safe return of John. And I had to tell her, I said, Anne, anybody who guarantees it is nothing but a liar.
Yeah.
Because nobody can guarantee that he will safely return. The only guarantee I can give you is that when I give my go ready for launch, there's nothing I know of that could not bring him back.
Yeah. Now, Gunter, when you were putting John Glenn into the capsule and the other guys as well, what was that sense of the room? I'm sure it was very businesslike, but was it tense? Was it lighthearted? Was it professional?
Now, you've got to understand, in the first few launches, Mercury, you know, and then Gemini, it was always a time then normally you go through a few scrubs before you actually launch.
Uh-huh.
So the anticipation was always, hey, here we are again, so this time let's launch it. Let's not scrub again. So it was actually very, very professional, but they were all eager to go. I always compared it. If you plan a big vacation on a cruise, you know, and then you wonder if the car will start, if you make it in time to get to the cruise ship, and finally you are in the cabin and they cut the lines loose, and you go, ah, now we made it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the attitude of most of the people were that, hey, we practiced so many times, let's get going.
Right.
And that used to be normally the primary thought. Besides, you had to be very careful to make sure that you didn't overlook any of the items you had to complete to make it successful.
Yeah. Now, Gunter, when you as Mercury and Gemini were built by McDonnell Douglas, and you worked for McDonnell Douglas, and then after the Apollo 1 fire, Apollo being built by Rockwell, Wally Schirra and the gang came and basically got you shanghaied from McDonnell Douglas over to Rockwell, and you continued to do your job throughout Apollo. I guess the question I have is how did you establish such a close rapport with the astronauts?
Now, right from the beginning, we had a very, very close relationship, and different than this today, astronauts used to live at the Cape pretty much for weeks on end.
Mm-hmm.
They participated in any and every major test. So there used to be a close relationship. And what was going on with us was they always had a free hand. In other words, if we had a problem and they didn't understand what happened, they would ask, and I would get the right people together, and we'd go after dinner after at night, you know, we go up to the crew quarters,
mm-hmm.
and we would explain what has happened. At the same time, we also, since we are here and they were away from their homes, when they had some time off, I would take them fishing or we go water skiing. So we had very, very close relationships.
Right.
Now see that Apollo 1 fire was a very, very big shock for me, because all of a sudden there were guys that I used to go fishing with and water skiing with, and probably had seen them a day before or so,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden you couldn't meet them anymore.
Yeah.
Now, see, I wasn't there when it happened, because
right.
I still was working for McDonald's, and then after the fire I switched companies, and then had to make many changes to get the situation like we had in previous flights. You see, we had a big difference. Mercury and Gemini were built and launched by McDonald people. Now, Apollo was given to another contractor, and they had never launched a human being. So they had rather some difficulties changing from being an aircraft manufacturer to being a spacecraft manufacturer, where the rules are quite tougher to make it happen.
And they certainly had to learn how to do that. Gunter, we're going to take a pause here. When we come back, more with Gunter Vent, and he's going to talk to us about what we need to do to get more support for the space program and some things and observations that he has. More again from Gunter Vent here on Space Talk with Jim Behnke in just a couple of minutes. Stand by. We'll be right back.
Listen to Space Talk on the web at WMMBAM.com.
Houston Endeavor, roll program.
Roger, roll, Endeavor.
Now is the time for shuttle program employees to chart a new course.
OTCSGO.
A course that will take their careers beyond the last space shuttle mission to new job opportunities and horizons.
Fine, let's go.
Brevard Workforce is helping our community shuttle engineers, technicians, and administrative workers to launch new careers through the Aerospace Workforce Transition Program.
Houston, flight is go.
While they continue to safely launch the remaining shuttle missions. Through the programs, resources, and services, aerospace workers can map out a strategy, undergo skill assessments,
take workshops, update degrees and certifications, or receive education funding. Assistance is available and ready.
PTC, go.
Contact Brevard Workforce today and take the first easy step to prepare for a successful post shuttle career in aerospace or other industries.
The launch team is ready to proceed.
Call Brevard Workforce at 394-0556. That's 394-0556. Visit them online at launchnewcareers.com or Twitter them at launchcareers.
You are go for launch.
Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Behnke.
Thank you, and welcome back to this final segment of Space Talk, where we're talking to Gunter Vent, one of the Lifetime Achievement Award winners for this year from the National Space Club Florida Committee. And Gunter, we want to give you a chance to talk because I know you're a keen observer of the program, and being out in the public the way you are to talk about the space program, you know what people are asking about and what people are thinking when it comes to support for our space program. And I know you have some thoughts and concerns about how well we're getting the message out. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I think we are looking at the next 5 years as a very tough time to keep space exploration on the mind of the average taxpayer. We have to change our rhetoric from events that are 20 to 30 years in the future to goals that we can produce in the next 5 or 10 years. If you go and talk to high school and college students, they will review what opportunities may be offered in space exploration to determine what studies to select on what path to take to have a secure future.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I talk to and make a presentation and tell the students that 80% of items that they touch on a daily basis are from the mindsets of physicists or physicians and engineers, the students are surprised that everything that they touch, just about everything, is attached to engineering or to science.
Right.
So, you know, in the last few years, it used to be when I talked to college students, they said, oh, we make MBAs and make big monies in the stock market. And engineering and physics and the hard degrees were somewhat neglected. And it is interesting that we'll have to change it because you have to look as to what is the attention spans. Now, you have different groups. You talk to the average taxpayers or civic groups. Now, they are interested in space as it affects the next 3 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Grade school students, well, they think ahead about 5 years. But high school students, they look at to 10 years until they switch over to college, because then they have to figure out what courses they want to take to make a living for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. Now, Gunter, you know, with the vision for space exploration, when it was announced in 2004, and we're talking about going back to the moon and on to Mars with moon landings maybe in the 2017-2020 time frame, I was pretty excited by that and still am at the notion. But now with the Augustine panel looking at all of these options, and I know you've been following them, that it seems like the chance to go beyond low Earth orbit might actually get pushed out to a 2024-2028 time frame. That's a long time from now. And I'm concerned, and maybe you are too, that the kids, the college kids, aren't going to see space as a viable career again because of what you're talking about. There's no sense of an early payoff for what they're working so hard on.
Yeah, now you're going to realize they have to select what courses to take because what directions they want to go. And if you are honest about it, a Mars mission, a manned Mars mission, may not be happening in the next 30 years.
Yeah.
Because we have no vehicle. We have to first design space vehicles. And the Mars mission is so complicated. As of today, we don't even know how we could protect human beings from the radiation that they may be exposed to. Plus, when you talk about it, a Mars mission, one mission, a return trip, is 162 days.
Yeah.
We don't even have a vehicle that will accommodate people for that period of time with all their life support and whatever they need. So it is somewhat ironic that people talk about it where they don't have any physical evidence that it possibly is achievable. See, even when we started early in the 50s or late 50s, we had already rockets that we should shoot in space and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, we don't even know if we're going to build an Orion spacecraft. What will it do? Will it go to the moon? Well, then it has to be different than it just stays in Earth orbit. And then we need heavier rockets, you know, what they talk about, the RS-5 or so. But they're not even on the drawing board yet.
Yeah.
So I think when I listen to people, you know, and I'm very interested in the young people, and you hear, and they say, hey, tell me what happened in the next 3 or 5 years. Or where we were falling flat. We never told the people what we have achieved. You know, we need to go out and tell the people, hey, look, this is what we have done. You know, when they issue a booklet about space exploration or how the public benefits, it normally is such a level that you must have a PhD to digest it.
Yeah.
So we have to learn to get the people interested because the taxpayer is the one that will pay for the space program.
Right.
And if they are not interested, we're going to have a heck of a time getting money for future space explorations.
Gunter, I just got an email from, and they didn't say who they were, but with just some time running out here, a quick question. Back in the 60s with the Mercury program, you, as a person working so close with the crew, did you call it a capsule or did you call it a spacecraft?
No, we called it actually a capsule.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what we used to call it.
And when did that become not cool to call it a capsule anymore?
I don't know. I guess when they give it numbers, you know, and then we give it names, you know, like we call it Glenn's Flight, Friendship 7,
sure.
You know, and things like that. I think it deteriorated that we said, okay, now they are spacecraft.
Jeez. Okay. Hey, Gunter, we're going to have to say goodbye to you right now as we wrap up the program. Again, congratulations on your award. We'll see you Tuesday in Cocoa Beach.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You
and
bet.
Just hang in and keep space on the mind of people.
We'll do our best, and you will too. I know that. So, Gunter, thanks a lot. And as we wrap up our episode of Space Talk for today, I just want to thank all the Lifetime Achievement Award winners. The one man that couldn't call in was Jerry Opliger, who had a great career working solid rocket motors for a variety of contractors and then eventually was the president of Lockheed Space Operations Company, the company that ran the shuttle processing contract before United Space Alliance came along. And he is the third Lifetime Achievement Award winner. We want to send our best wishes to him and look forward to seeing him on Tuesday as well. Well, that's it for Space Talk for this week. Keep an eye on the online and on WMMBAM.com. Follow us on Twitter at Space Talking, and we'll have updates on next week's show. And we look forward to seeing all of you back here again next week. But that's it for now. This is Jim Behnke for Space Talk on WMMB. Have a pleasant weekend.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com.